Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman. A former African leader makes his plea before the International Criminal Court. Former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo has pleaded not guilty as his trial began Thursday at the International Criminal Court in the Netherlands. Gbagbo is facing charges of crimes against humanity linked to a post-election civil war in his country that left thousands dead in 2010. Prosecutor Fatou Bassoud addressed the panel of three judges.
Nothing would be allowed to defeat Mr. Gbagbo. If politics failed, violence was seen as politics by other means.
Human rights activists welcome the trial as a clear signal that leaders who resort to violence to strengthen their grip on power will be held to account. Former youth leader Charles Blé-Goudet will also stand trial with Gbagbo. The ICC also has a warrant for the former president's wife, Simone, on charges of crimes against humanity. She was sentenced last year to a 20-year prison sentence by an Ivorian court. The World Health Organization will convene an emergency committee next week on the Zika virus outbreak next week to discuss an international response to an outbreak of the disease amid concerns that it may have links to a bout of rare birth defects. During a special session in Geneva Thursday, WHO's Director General Margaret Chan said Zika virus was considered to be of little threat to humans when it was first discovered in Uganda in 1947. But since that time, she said, it has spread throughout the world and in recent years has become associated with neurological complications. She stressed that a direct causal relationship between Zika virus and these birth defects has not been firmly established. This is VOA News. The United States is urging all parties invited to this week's Syrian peace talks in Geneva to show up without preconditions. The talks on a ceasefire and setting up a transitional government in Syria were supposed to have started Monday. They've been put off until Friday because of squabbles over who should be invited. The UN Syria envoy, Stefan de Mistura, sent out invitations Tuesday but did not disclose who was on the list. Various media reports say it includes representatives of Saudi and U.S.-backed moderate opposition groups, members of the Russian-backed opposition, and Syrian Foreign Minister Waqid al-Moalem. Not invited to the talks are Islamic State and the al-Nusra Front, an al-Qaeda-linked group fighting to topple the Syrian government. While the United States says representatives of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad should attend the peace talks, it says Assad, the dictator who murders his own people, they said, cannot be part of Syria's future. Moscow, Assad's strongest ally, says that decision is up to the Syrian people. Seeking to assert Taiwan's sovereignty and build his legacy, President Ma Ying-jeou paid a visit Thursday to an even smaller island also claimed by China. Defying rare criticism from the U.S., Ma flew to the island of Taiping in the South China Sea and sought to cast Taiwan as a peaceful humanitarian player in a region where China's robust assertions of its territorial claims are sharpening disputes with its neighbors. Ma had invited along his successor, President-elect Tsai Ing-wen of the independence-leaning Democratic Progressive Party, but she declined the offer, apparently to clarify the difference between her and Ma's unpopular China-friendly Nationalist Party administration. Satellite images are revealing unprecedented damage to coral reefs in the contested South China Sea. A disputed waterway is claimed by several nations in Asia, and the fight for the territory and its resources is taking a heavy toll on the environment. Shannon Van Zandt has more from Hong Kong.
For years, overfishing in the South China Sea has depleted local fish stocks. But since 2012, the controversial construction of artificial islands has devastated the ecosystem and the disputed waterway. Marine biologist Terry Hughes is a professor at James Cook University.
The impact of these new dredging and land reclamation projects are compounding the pre-existing impacts of fishing.
Between 2012 and 2015, Chinese fishermen have used large extended propellers affixed to utility boats to chop the reefs and prepare for the construction of artificial islands in the Spratlys. The fishermen also scour the ocean floor for giant clam shells, which are prized as jewelry and luxury items and can sell for up to $150,000.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Higgs Wu Heben coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The 70-year-old Gbagbo and Blé Goudé are charged with four counts of crimes against humanity allegedly committed in 2010 and 2011 when Gbagbo's supporters clashed with supporters of politician Alassane Ouattara over the result of the presidential elections. About 3,000 people were killed.
That's Emily Yub reporting on the trial of former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo at the International Criminal Court. Details coming up.
Also, Boko Haram militants launch more suicide attacks in Nigeria. UN peacekeeping troops in the DRC and the Congolese army are beefing up their presence near the Burundi border.
We have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Rwanda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, six suicide bombers attacked the small Nigerian town of Chibok yesterday, killing 16. A doctor says today that death toll is expected to rise. He told the AP the town's hospital is overwhelmed with injured with severe burns. 10 patients were evacuated to another hospital. The town of Chibok became infamous in 2014 when Boko Haram rebels kidnapped about 300 girls from the local boarding school. Some later escaped, but 219 remain missing almost 2 years later. Human Rights Watch has released a report today charging Nigeria's new government with violating rights in its fight against Boko Haram's Islamic uprising and in arresting corrupt politicians. Also, two suicide bombers killed four people at a school in northern Cameroon today. The town mayor of Karawa says a dozen people were wounded in the twin bombing in the town.
Former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo entered a not guilty plea today in the opening day of his trial at the International Criminal Court. He's facing charges of crimes against humanity. Mr. Gbagbo is the first former head of state to be tried at the ICC. Human rights groups say his trial is a milestone in the search for justice for victims of war crimes. Some Africans, however, see the ICC as a tool of the West and argue the continent should have its own court. Emily Yub reports from the Ivorian commercial capital, Abidjan, on reaction to the trial.
In Abidjan, the trial of former President Laurent Gbagbo is all over the news. The beginning of the end, reads the headline on the pro-government newspaper. The chances of Gbagbo and Blé Goudé, reads the headline on a different paper that favors the former head of state and his top aide. In some neighborhoods, Gbagbo supporters have organized live broadcasts of the trial. I came to watch the trial of my president, says Basile Konandesi. I hope it will be released because there is no evidence against him, he says. The 70-year-old Gbagbo and Blé Goudé are charged with four counts of crimes against humanity allegedly committed in 2010 and 2011 when Gbagbo's supporters clashed with supporters of politician Alassane Ouattara over the result of the presidential elections. About 3,000 people were killed. Eventually, Gbagbo was arrested and Ouattara became president. Ouattara was re-elected last year. The trial has recounted criticism that the court is biased. Since its inception in 2002, the court in The Hague has prosecuted cases from eight countries, all of them African. Some argue Gbagbo should be tried on the African continent, as in the case of former Chadian leader Hissène Habré, who is being tried by a special court in Senegal. Boubacar Kone, acting spokesperson of a branch of Gbagbo's party, the FPI, says the trial is unfair because pro-Ouattara individuals accused of crime during the post-election violence are not being brought to justice.
Voilà un conflit dans lequel on poursuit un seul protagoniste.
Here is a conflict in which only one camp is being prosecuted, he says. Samasi, who owns a cafe in a popular Abidjan neighborhood, says the trial is the main topic among his customers these days. He says he hopes the trial will shed light on atrocities committed during the crisis. I would like that justice be done on this matter, he says. On Laurent Gbagbo, on the killings and the crimes committed, to call the attentions of all Ivorians and also all African heads of state, because no crime must remain unpunished. drinking his morning coffee, Kakoi John Guillet says his only hope is that the trial is peaceful. I think justice will decide, and then the situation in Ivory Coast will be stable again, he says. The trial is expected to last 3 to 4 years. Emily Apra, VOA News, in Abidjan.
Thank you, Emily. UN peacekeeping troops in the DRC and the Congolese army are beefing up their presence near the Burundi border. That follows reports of armed men from Burundi entering a refugee camp in Lusenda in the DRC's South Kivu province. The camp shelters nearly 14,000 Burundi refugees. About 250,000 Burundians have fled to neighboring countries after violence erupted in their country last April. That's when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office. Opponents called it unconstitutional. Hundreds of people have died in the violence. A spokesman for the UN mission MONUSCO says the situation in Burundi is having a negative effect on security in the eastern Congo. Reports say the UN troops are about 3 kilometers from the Burundi border. In related news, African leaders meet tomorrow at the AU summit in Addis Ababa and may decide on whether to send peacekeeping troops to Burundi. Last December, the AU Peace and Security Council voted to send 5,000 troops to stem the violence. Now, African leaders must either support or reject the council's decision. Mr. Nkurunziza is opposed as any AU troop intervention. A rebel group called the Burundian Republican Forces says it wants to oust the president for violating the Arusha peace accords and the constitution.
8 months after the media crackdown in Burundi with pro- and anti-government radio stations attacked and burned, many Burundians have now resorted to social media to get or disseminate information. Reporter Moses Javier Amina reports from Bujumbura.
After the failed coup last year, which resulted in the media crackdown, Rema radio station and television, owned by the ruling party, were the first to be set on fire. Hours later, the African Public Radio, RPR, which was critical of the government, was also attacked and burned. Two other radio stations in Bujumbura were forced to close by the authorities. President Pierre Nkurunziza commented on the media situation.
About the media, I thank the ministers who are holding that case because all the medias in Burundi are handled the same. So we had more than 20 medias in Burundi, and we still have more than 15 still operating, and only 4 medias faced problems last year, with the remaining 15 still operating. Don't be wrong to the government. And these 4 were attacked during the failed coup, and by then there was no government, so whatever happened should be asked by those who tried to overthrow the government.
Efforts to reopen the private media are still underway, but radio stations accused of supporting the protests and coup plotters in May last year are not expected to reopen anytime soon.
There are some media who collaborate with coup plotters, so in that case, investigation still continues. There are those whose cases are going on, probably will be opened in the near future, but some have been summoned by the court and they failed to turn up.
One of the private radio stations, African Public Radio, that was shut down by Burundi authorities has capitalized on the use of an app called WhatsApp to disseminate sound bites of recorded news and information, but others are using social media too. Engdogan is a Burundian youth who started up a social media page to promote peace during the media blackout.
My media platform is called Alexio Pacific. It's a Burundian Facebook page where we discuss about peace before, during and after elections. Yeah. It's now almost 1 year running the page. Our posters have reached more than 200,000 people. So I'm happy for the work done. Before and during elections, I was very active running the page. Few months after elections, I reduced the rhythm because it requires a lot of energy, a lot of time, a lot of resources. So I couldn't do the work because of the requirements. Our main mission was to contribute to our peaceful elections, to invite Bruneians to be peaceful during elections. Our democracy is becoming more violent instead of becoming peaceful. So our main role was to encourage especially youth to be peaceful, to behave peaceful in a peaceful way, so that we can have peaceful elections. So our key message was give peace a chance.
According to the Burundi Telecommunication Control Regulator, in 2013, 6% of the estimated 10 million people in the country were connected to the internet. However, 2014 statistics shows at least 30% of the Burundians use mobile phone internet because it is easier to access the social media. For VOA, I'm Moses Havyarimana in Bujumbura.
In the latest news on the migrant and refugee crisis, the Greek Coast Guard reports the deaths of 10 children and 15 adults when a boat leaving the Turkish coast sank today off the Greek island of Kos. 5 migrants on board were rescued. Also, Sweden estimates it may deport as many as 80,000 migrants who do not qualify as refugees. Officials say about 45% of the more than 160,000 migrants and refugees who entered the country last year are not meeting the requirements for refugee status. Meanwhile, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and the UN Refugee Agency are urging EU member states to focus on the resettlement of refugees by providing access to language instruction and jobs. And Britain, under pressure from humanitarian group, has announced it will consider giving shelter to up to 3,000 more migrant children. That number is in addition to the 4,000 the government has agreed to settle annually.
The International Organization for Migration, IOM, found that in 2015, 5 countries in the Horn of Africa, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, and Sudan, experienced a marked increase in irregular migration by land and sea from a year earlier. IOM says the increase is drawn from 5 indicators: arrivals in Yemen from the Horn of Africa, arrivals in the Horn of Africa from Yemen, arrivals in Europe, migrant deaths, and nationalities on the move. Craig Murphy is the IOM spokesperson in Nairobi, Kenya. I spoke with him about irregular migration flows and why the increase of migrants going to Yemen continues at a surprising rate.
In 2015, we have for the first time significant numbers of displaced persons arriving in the Horn of Africa to the countries referenced from Yemen. The onset of the war in Yemen in April of 2015, which goes to the present and doesn't seem to have an end in sight, has generated a significant amount of displacement. Approximately 75,000 individuals arrived in the Horn of Africa, and most of them were split over the two countries of Somalia and Djibouti, as compared to the previous year where there was not a conflict, or it wasn't a large-scale conflict in Yemen as we've seen in 2015, and we had almost no arrivals in the Horn of Africa. Almost all of the migration was from the Horn of Africa crossing the Gulf of Aden and arriving in Yemen. And if you look at the other location, the policies within European countries, the response in the Mediterranean, various factors in countries of origin in the Horn of Africa have combined to make a situation where Europe has been seen by many as an attractive option. Not easy to get there in the manner with which they are traveling, but it has still been received a large number of migrants and refugees from the Horn of Africa through 2 main entry points into Europe, Italy and through Greece, and then sometimes staying in those countries, but often moving further into Europe to other countries.
Looking at Yemen, your report points out that this increase is surprising. So can you explain why that is surprising, that migrants are going into Yemen?
Well, typically people think of conflict and situations of armed conflict and aerial bombardment, which is happening on a large scale and has been for around 9 or 10 months in Yemen, would be a deterrent and contributes to people leaving a country in terms of an exodus or refugee populations that are fleeing for their lives and seeking asylum in other countries, which has happened from Yemen. But the flip side of that is that most people are less familiar with the population dynamic that conflict and the breakdown of the rule of law also contributes. and can serve as a magnet or an attraction for those seeking to pass through a country. And it's despite the insecurity and the risk of the armed conflict, they are able to pass borders to enter countries in an easier manner than if it was a peacetime.
And looking at the number of deaths of those migrants crossing the Gulf of Aden in 2015, you all have noted there was a decrease. What is that attributed to?
In the Horn of Africa, that's correct. And the mechanisms and the monitors and the recording systems that we have in place have recorded 246 individuals lost their lives at sea in 2014. That number dropped significantly in 2015 to 95 individuals in the year of 2015, in the 12-month period from January to December. There's not an easy answer or a clear explanation as to why that went down. There's a multitude of factors that go into these, but we simply use the number of migrants' lives that are lost at sea as an important indicator for analyzing the situation. Some speculate, and I tend to agree with it, that there was such an increase in movement in both directions across the Gulf of Aden and the Red Sea between Djibouti, Somalia, and Yemen, those going to Yemen to try to capitalize on the lawlessness in terms of entering the country, but also those making the decision to flee, being displaced, and to leave Yemen. There was a lot of maritime movement by boats across these bodies of water. So typically there are quite small boats, fishing boats, that are used to smuggle migrants. But in 2015, since there was more of a demand for this maritime movement, the speculation and the consensus seems to be that a lot more boats, and many of them literature larger and more seaworthy, so less prone to capsizing, probably led to about 60% reduction in deaths from 246 in 2014 to 95 in 2015.
Also, it's been noted that 36 migrant lives were lost at sea in the first week of this year, 2016, in the Gulf of Aden. Looking ahead for 2016, what do you anticipate in terms of migrant deaths?
It's hard to predict, but if you extrapolate the statistics, I think it's going to be largely a continuation of what we have seen. We hope that the dynamics are such that irregular migration and the challenges and the loss of life associated with it will not increase and will maintain the status quo or decrease this year. There doesn't seem to be a quick or easy resolution to the situation in Yemen. We are definitely predicting to see continued movement to and from Yemen between the Horn of Africa countries in 2016.
Craig Murphy is an IOM migration analyst. He spoke with me from Nairobi.
There is a new research that says giving young children antibiotics could adversely affect their health, making them susceptible to obesity and asthma, among other illnesses. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
There's no question that antibiotics have saved the lives of millions of people from deadly infections. But a Finnish study says they can have a downside, too. It all has to do with what happens in a child's intestines. Antibiotics interfere with the microbiota, or the good bacteria living there. Dr. Katri Korpela of the University of Helsinki, the first author of the study, says science is just beginning to understand how significant gut bacteria are.
I think everyone's becoming more and more surprised at how really important they are, and we really don't know very much yet, especially from humans. There's actually very little hard data yet on how much they affect our long-term health, especially in early life. The microbiota may have very strong long-term effects on health, but we don't really know that much yet.
Antibiotics do not distinguish between good bacteria and bad bacteria. They kill them both.
It's becoming increasingly clear that bacteria are an important part of us as humans, so they are not all bad. Of course, there are pathogens, and it's a balance between fighting bacteria and living together with them.
The good bacteria and other organisms working with them make up much, if not most, of our immune system. So antibiotics can upset that delicate balance. Finnish researchers studied 127 children, aged 2 to 7, who attended the same daycare center and lived near each other. They checked how many courses of antibiotics they've had.
We know from human studies that antibiotic use, especially in children, is associated with, for example, increased BMI, also asthma risk of inflammatory bowel disease. So we know that there are some risks involved, but we didn't know why, what could be the mechanisms. Then, of course, the first thing that could be the mechanism is the bacteria in the gut.
BMI, mentioned by Korpela, stands for Body Mass Index and is used to determine whether a person is considered overweight for their height. Korpela says studies in mice have clearly shown that disrupting the microbiota with antibiotics causes long-term health effects. Also, in many places, low levels of antibiotics are given to livestock to help them gain weight. Not all antibiotics have the same impact on the gut bacteria. The worst damage is done by broad-spectrum drugs known as macrolides. Penicillin-type antibiotics also do damage, but not quite as much. Researchers looked at the levels of the bifidobacteria, which are considered beneficial, especially in children. Korpela says after using antibiotics, bifida levels are much lower.
Those bacteria seem to be replaced by other types of bacteria that have been associated with, for example, development of obesity or metabolic syndrome.
Metabolic syndrome is an umbrella term for a group of risk factors that could lead to such diseases as diabetes. Babies apparently get good intestinal bacteria from their mothers as they go through the birth canal.
We think that that's mainly where they come from. Of course, children who are born through cesarean section then usually get bacteria from the hospital environment. That is probably not very good. So they tend to be colonized by skin bacteria first, which is not naturally.
The University of Helsinki researcher says good intestinal bacteria may actually help train the immune system in children. She says then there's a constant dialogue throughout life. Korpela says it can take several years for a child's gut bacteria, and in effect the immune system, to recover after taking antibiotics. Of course, that's providing the child does not take any more in the meantime. Otherwise, the cycle begins again. Researchers also found evidence in the children of bacteria having antibiotic-resistant genes.
It is already quite well known that antibiotic resistance is a serious problem and serious threat to health. So that alone means that we should really be careful about using antibiotics and really respect them, not use them just in case, only when they are needed.
She says antibiotics can have a detrimental effect on an adult's gut bacteria as well. Nutritionists, doctors, and other health professionals may recommend adults take probiotic supplements, which contain bacteria said to be beneficial. The study on antibiotics use in children and its effect on good bacteria appears in the journal Nature Communications. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to Africa News Tonight for the latest sports, features, and more coming up next right here on VOA. For the full hour of Africa News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte here to remind you that February is Black History Month in the United States. And starting Monday, February 1st, we will begin our Black History Month series and daily quiz on Daybreak Africa. Listen every morning as we profile historical African American and African individuals and events. You can win special VOA goodies by answering one of our daily Black History questions. Please send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. You can also call us on 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, select the number 25 to leave us your answer. Get up, stand up.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Former Ivory Coast President Laurent Gbagbo enters a not guilty plea today in the opening day of his trial at the ICC. UN peacekeeping troops in the DRC and the Congolese army are beefing up their presence near the Burundi border. Coming up, we'll have music from Rwanda, and in our feature segment, the future weakening of the South African rand has almost rendered the Zimbabwe dollar useless. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand your opening serve is Australian Open tennis.
Kim, it's looking like deja vu down under in Australia. The defending men's and women's champions in Melbourne, Novak Djokovic of Serbia and Serena Williams of the United States, are both only one victory away from lifting the trophy again. The top-seeded Djokovic defeated Swiss rival Roger Federer in four sets on Thursday. The final score from Melbourne Park, 6-1, 6-2, 3-6, and 6-3. Djokovic will play the winner of Friday's semifinal between Milos Raonic of Canada and Andy Murray of Britain. Meanwhile, in women's action Thursday, Serena Williams eliminated Agnieszka Radwanska of Poland in straight sets, 6-love and 6-4. If she wins her seventh Australian Open singles title, Serena will tie the now-retired German Steffi Graf with 22 Grand Slam championships, the most by any player, male or female, in the modern era. And for our VOA tennis fans keeping score, Roger Federer holds the record on the men's side with 17 Grand Slam singles titles. In the women's final in Australia, Serena Williams will play seventh-seeded German Angelique Kerber, who beat Britain's Johanna Konta 7-5 and 6-2 on Thursday. Now let's go to Rwanda, where football fans are looking forward to the quarterfinals at the African Nations Championship Tournament. There will be two quarterfinals on Saturday and two more on Sunday. In the first quarterfinal Saturday, Rwanda will host the Democratic Republic of Congo, which won the inaugural competition in 2009 in Kigali. And that will be followed by a match between Cameroon and Ivory Coast in Butare, Rwanda. In the first quarterfinal on Sunday, 2011 champion Tunisia will take on Mali in Kigali. And that will be followed by a game between Zambia and Guinea in Gisenyi, Rwanda. Remember, VOA football fans, this tournament, also called CHAN, is for locally based players in Africa. Franklin Byrne is the editor of Cameroon's This Is Sports newspaper. In a phone interview from Yaoundé with my VOA colleague James Buddy, Franklin said he's giving high marks to Cameroon's local coach.
Ntungumpile, Martin Ntungumpile, who was former assistant coach of the Indomitable Lions before Wokefinke had other assistants named Jonker Bonaventure and Alexander Belinda, who are the ones in charge of the team on an interim basis now. Yes, Ntungumpile is a Cameroonian and is leading this team, and we are proud that he's doing so well.
So is the question being asked in Yaoundé and all over Cameroon whether this Cameroonian, who is doing very well, can he move up to coach the Indomitable Lions?
Of course, because already there's been a strong, there's been a loud call among a huge segment of the population here, football fans back in the country, wondering why we can't have a Cameroonian coaching our team. We've had Jean-Paul Akuno, for example. We've had Jun Yonga lead Cameroon to qualify Cameroon to competition, and then at the verge of it, an expatriate is appointed. Jun Yonga led the team in 1996. Africa Cup of Nations in South Africa, but he didn't get the support from the authorities that expatriate coaches get. Now, in 2000, Akunu Jean-Paul led the Cameroon team to the Olympic Games and we won the gold medal. And that was the first time Cameroon was winning a high-level competition on the world stage. Back home in competition, he was appointed to lead the Indomitable Lions, but a segment of the Cameroonian population that is still not used to the idea of having a Cameroonian at the head of the team did not receive Akono's appointment very well, especially they still had a romance with the French coach at the time, Pierre Lechange, and Akono was fired shortly afterwards. Akono, Jean-Paul, came back to head the Cameroon national team and qualified us, was leading us to the qualification of the Africa Cup of Nations in Malabo, in Equatorial Guinea, but he was sacked in a very unceremonious manner, still under the notion that a Cameroonian cannot lead the Cameroon national team. There have been strong calls already for a Cameroonian to lead the team. There is, on an interim basis, two Cameroonians, former Indomitable Lions, Junker Bonaventure and Alexandre Belinda, leading the team on an interim basis since the German was, Volker Finke was fired. But then there is every indication, the president made it clear that the next coach will likely be an expatriate. So with the performance of this local home-based national team led by a Cameroonian, a coach of high-standing, Martin Tungumpile, I'm sure the calls for a Cameroonian to lead the team are going to get stronger, and we hope that the authorities can listen to the fans.
That's Franklin Byern, the editor of Cameroon's This Is Sports newspaper. And Franklin spoke from Yaoundé with my VOA colleague, James Buddy. In more African football news, a goal poacher for the Foxes of Leicester has been honored in his Algerian homeland. Picking up the story, here's Mark Ouma.
In Algeria, winger Riyad Mahrez is the 2015 Golden Ball Award winner. Mahrez was voted Algeria's best football player by the country's Premier League team captains, coaches and club presidents, the national team coach and captain, along with the Algerian media. Other awards were presented to the Algerian team that won the gold medal at the World Military Games in South Korea, the Algerian team that has qualified for the Rio de Janeiro Olympics, and USM Algiers, who were runners-up at the 2015 Orange Africa Champions League. A special honorary award was bestowed on retired Egyptian icon Mohamed Abu Trika for his contribution to African football.
Mates, remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right, give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively sunny man on the sunny side of sports, right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoje here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brilafm.net. I tell you this. It's always a thrill, yes, a thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of life.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Our African football guru, David Legg, joins us again this evening for a look at recent African goal-scoring highlights in Europe.
In the English Premier League, good news for all our Nigerian listeners, because Odion Ighalo of Watford is back on the goal trail. He was doing so well coming up to Christmas, but then he had the inevitable drought. It happens to all the great players in the world. I see even Lionel Messi this season. He's not near the top of the Spanish scoring charts at the moment. Ighalo scored against Newcastle. Watford won 2-1, so everybody was happy. And at the moment, Ighalo is just one goal behind the leading English Premier League scorer. That's Jamie Vardy of that sensational leaders, Leicester City. Vardy's got 16 goals and Ighalo's got 15. No African Sonny has ever topped the EPL scoring charts, but if this pride of Nigeria keeps this up, he will have a real chance of finishing first. Another regular on the scoring sheet is, of course, Andre Ayew of Swansea. He created a penalty for his side that was converted, and then he himself scored before halftime as Swansea won 2-1 at Everton. There was this amazing match at Norwich in which Liverpool beat Norwich by 5-4. Just watching the goal highlights, I mean, it took almost 45 minutes in itself. There were two Africans on target for Norwich. Diomerci Mbokani from the DR Congo, he scored. And also Sebastian Bassong from Cameroon, he was also on target. And how often, Sonny, in the EPL do you score 4 goals and finish on the losing side? But that's what Norwich did. And, you know, with Liverpool, you just don't know what's going to happen next. I mean, they recently were involved in this 6-goal drawn thriller with Arsenal, and now they win this game against Norwich. They concede 4 goals and they still collect 3 points. It's not very often you do that in the EPL. In Germany, Sonny, I guess the headline news is that just for once, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, the African Footballer of the Year, did not score, but his club, Borussia Dortmund, nevertheless won 3-1 away to Borussia Mönchengladbach. There were 2 African scorers, and they both came in the match between Schalke and Werder Bremen. The Nigerian Uja scored for Werder Bremen in the 3-1 victory, and the Schalke consolation goal came from the Cameroonian Matip. Looking at Spain, Sonny, the leading African scorer, although he was not on target at the weekend, is Cedric Bakambu. Now, he's a person we've been flagging regularly on the Sunnyside Sport, one to watch. He was born in France, but his parents come from DR Congo, and he's already been capped several times at senior level by the Congolese. And he's got 8 goals, but he is some way behind the leaders. And the leaderboard looks like this: 18 goals, Suarez from Barcelona, 17, Benzema of Real Madrid, and then 16, Ronaldo of Real Madrid and Neymar of Barcelona. Talk about a star-studded top of the scoring chart. And then as you meander down to 11 goals, Sonny, there is a certain Lionel Messi from Barcelona. It's not often that you find him trailing by 7 goals in the scoring chart.
Not very often, David. That's our football guru, David Legg, commenting on Lionel Messi, who earlier this month won his 4th FIFA Ballon d'Or trophy as the world's best footballer. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a meeting in Central Africa by mayors and major cities to find solutions for economic problems. And next, the further weakening of the South African rand has almost rendered the Zimbabwe dollar useless. But first, some music. Here is Kamachi from Rwanda with Rua Gasbo.
Wowe sindiri tatu kiza, wowe
Kamachi from Rwanda with Urwa Gasbo.
In Central Africa, the mayors of major cities have agreed to diversify their revenue sources, promote decentralization, and improve governance. They hope to boost the livelihoods of their growing populations. Mayors from Chad, Cameroon, Central African Republic, Equatorial Guinea, Gabon, and Congo-Brazzaville met earlier this month in the Cameroonian capital Yaoundé to find solutions to economic problems. Moki Edwin Kinsica reports from Yaoundé.
27-year-old Changa Etoga Emil wells pieces of rejected household metal to produce window protectors in Itubi, a neighborhood in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. He says the work enables him to take care of himself, his wife, three children, and old parents.
Quand j'ai obtenu mon CP, les parents n'ayant plus les moyens pour m'envoyer à l'école.
He says he and his two elder brothers left the village of Ntui in Cameroon's central region because their parents were not able to send them to school. He says living in Yaoundé is easier because he can pay his water and electricity bills, rent a house, and save some money. Emil is just one of the thousands of youths who leave the hinterlands of Cameroon every year for better lives in the cities. Cameroon's National Institute of Statistics indicates Yaoundé now has a population of more than 2 million people, up from barely 1 million 10 years ago. Celestine Ketcha-Cortez, mayor of the Cameroonian town of Bangante, says such movement towards cities is exerting pressure on social infrastructure and natural resources. She says it has failed to bring inclusive growth and has resulted in a proliferation of slums, urban poverty, and rising inequality. And she says there has not been any corresponding increases in social housing programs, markets, road infrastructure, schools, hospitals, and leisure establishments. Cortez says local councils are supposed to take care of the immediate needs of their growing populations while waiting for central government support. But she says local officials lack financial resources.
I'm not sure that 80% of our population are paying their taxes. Is paying what will support the local authority to fill their mission by delivering the essential services. That means water and sanitation. That means education. So paying taxes is bringing the citizen to be in participation of local development.
The United Nations Development Programme reports that urban population growth has been very rapid in Central African states. According to the most recent data compiled for the region, the population increased 48% in 2013, with 85% in Gabon, 24% in Chad, 54% in Cameroon, 40% in the Central African Republic, 39% in Equatorial Guinea, and 65% in Congo-Brazzaville. François Collet, head of the European Union delegation to Cameroon, says her institution has urged central governments to transfer power and resources to local councils to enable them to meet the needs of their growing populations.
We do support decentralization indeed, and we also provide subsidies to local authorities for water and sanitation, rural electrification. You understand that for contributing to a budget of a local authority, we need transparency and security of our funding. We think it contributes to the real improvement of the lives of people.
At the conclusion of their meeting Saturday, the mayors called for strong political commitments from their governments. They also decried the political instability in the Central African Republic and terrorism in Cameroon that has continued to push youths to cities where they seek safety. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The further weakening of the South African rand has almost rendered the dollar in Zimbabwe and regional countries useless. The rand is a part of multiple currencies adopted to stem the historic plunge of the Zimbabwe dollar in 2009. The rand now suffers daily depreciation through export commodities and U.S. interest rate hikes. The rand lost 26% of its value in the 6 months after the People's Bank of China executed a 2% devaluation of the yen and changed the way it traded its currency. Independent economist Rejoice Ngwenya tells VOA the fall of the rand has resulted in the frequent use of bond coins, a currency only recognized in Zimbabwe.
It's not a new thing, really, because by October, November last year, as soon as the rand started plunging, most retailers in this country were refusing to accept the rand because they know that if they accept the rand, they will lose out when they are converting it into a US dollar to go in and buy elsewhere other than South Africa. So it is understandable why they have lost confidence in the rand because it gets to be eroded when it is being converted for import purposes.
And Mr. Ngwenya, what is the situation regarding the bond coins? Because we understand they have taken over from the rand.
Well, I'm not too sure whether it is correct to say they've taken over, because I do not think that if I had $1 million worth of bond coins, I would be able to get an equivalent in US dollars. What they have only solved is the crisis of change that we had already had. That was difficult to get changed in the rand currency. But it is just a result of the lack of confidence that the rand, the Zimbabwean faith in the rand. I don't foresee a situation where the bond coin will suddenly transform itself into a bond note, and then we eventually use it in substituting for the US currency. Because there is no sign that the bond coin can be converted into US currency that can be used to import, say, capital goods.
But in terms of change, are these not being used widely more than the rand?
Absolutely. You know, in terms of change, they are being used. You know, that's what I'm saying, that, they are only answering the issue of change, which takes people from point A to point B in transport, or from point A to point B in transactions. But whether or not a cumulative amount of bond coins can give you sufficient currency to convert into US dollars, this is what I keep on saying, it's unlikely to happen. So the bond coin has just become a currency of convenience for change purposes. But I don't think that it has assumed enough integrity and authority to be used to convert into a currency that one can use to import capital goods.
In other words, are we just playing around with the name? Because if we were to call the bond coin the Zimbabwe dollar, would that still work the same way that it's doing right now?
Absolutely, you're right. I think there's just a very, intelligent way that the Reserve Bank has been using the word bond coin. Because by any other name, if you put the dollar sign, you already have the same dollar as a coin. But that, in terms of the psychology of the people that are associated with depreciating the same dollar, that is a terrible mistake because of the historical conversation. Because remember that the use of currency is to do with confidence as well. So once you call it the same dollar, it might slide back into the inflationary, hyperinflationary, mode that it assumed, notoriety. In 2005 to 2009.
Do you see the South African rand getting its strength that it had when we started off last year?
The issue of whether South African rand can be strong or not is not a Zimbabwean issue. It's a South African issue. That will have to lead that South African. But I have got my doubts that it can recover from a position of probably 1-16 or 1-18. It's back to about 1-11. It will demand a lot of financial and monetary transformation of Africa. But for us, it has got long-term negative effects, because our trade deficit will keep on widening, because Zimbabweans will literally stop buying goods from Zimbabwe, and then it will totally destroy an industry that is already suffering under 30% productive capacity.
That was independent economist Rejoice Ngwenya speaking with VOA's Chris Gande from Harare. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Some 1.2 billion people survive on less than $1.25 per day. A dollar and a quarter is the World Bank's threshold that quantifies the minimum consumption and income level needed to meet a person's basic needs. Today, that figure is widely considered to be the international poverty level, and those who live below it, about one out of every six people, or 17% of the world's population, live in extreme poverty. Extreme poverty is more than just a definition with a number attached to it. It signifies unfulfilled dreams, lost potential to the broader community, and a tough, hardscrabble life. It means a lifetime of making impossible choices when allocating scant resources between food, medicine, housing, or education, because people living at or below the poverty level spend over 80% of their income on food and are unable to save money for emergencies. Still, over the past quarter century, the situation has been improving. Since 1990, the current figure of 1.2 billion people has dropped from 1.91 billion, an improvement of 43%. And today, we believe that we can lift 1 billion more people out of poverty by 2030. With USAID leading the way, the United States, in cooperation with our international partners, has worked hard to improve economic opportunity, health, food security, education, equality, stability, and accountable governance for millions of people. Today, for the first time in history, we have the tools, technologies, and approaches to end extreme poverty by 2030. This will not be an easy task. Still, it is possible, but only if we come together as a global community in support of this effort. So we must turn existing development capacities and priorities towards ending extreme poverty by, for example, increasing food security and improving child survival and improving education. We must invite people across the world to come up with new ideas and innovative solutions to old and persistent development challenges. And we must boost economic growth and connect people to the global economy. If we can do all that, if we accelerate our progress and focus on key turnarounds, we believe we can all but wipe out extreme poverty within the next 15 years.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.